There we go. Okay. All right, guys. So what we're going to do is I'm probably going to spend the next 45 minutes or so going through the mock paper. Okay, so to give you an idea, I'm going to take a deep in, take a breath. Did everyone receive the mock paper?
Yes.
Thank God. Okay, because this time last year there was dead air when I said that and said, well, we didn't get it. Okay, so good. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go spend about 40, 45 minutes going through the mock paper, tell you basically how you would answer the mock paper if it were the real paper. Okay, and then when that's finished, I'll close down the mock paper and open up the real paper. You guys won't see it, but I will see it in front of me, and I'll just give you some guidance as to what to focus on ahead of the real paper. Okay, all right. So there's 8 questions in the mock paper, so we're going to cover all 8 of them. Obviously, you only need to answer 4, but obviously, if it were the real paper, you'd all pick different ones. So I'm going to cover off all 8. So first question, question 1 is outline and briefly describe the primary sources of law in Ireland. That's the first half of the question. And then the second half of the question is outline the principal differences between civil law and criminal law in Ireland. Okay, so there's 10 marks available for each. Okay, so in terms of managing your time, as Declan said, you have 30 minutes for the exam question. You should allocate 15 minutes for the first one and 15 minutes for the second one, because there are equal marks. Okay, in some questions there are more marks for part one and less marks for part two. You should obviously allocate your time accordingly. Okay, we'll go through that as we go. Okay, so question 1, nice and straightforward. It's half your time on one half the question, the other half your time on the other half the question. Okay, so first part of the question is outline and briefly describe the primary sources of law in Ireland. Okay, so there's basically 4/5 things that I'm looking for there. Okay, so the first one is common law and judicial precedent. Okay, so these are the very first things we covered back in February when we met up first time around. So common law is law based on the decision of judges. One case is heard, judge makes a decision, second similar case is heard maybe a year later, the second judge in the second case will refer back to the first case and decide accordingly, are the facts the same or are the facts not. Okay, judicial precedent, basically saying that that if a higher court kind of says, okay, this is the way the law is interpreted, the lower court should follow that. Okay, so common law and judicial precedent is the first part of the answer that I'm looking for. Okay. A second thing to bring in under that general heading is there is a discussion in the notes about the principle of equity. Okay, equity being fairness. Okay, so once upon a time the law was the law. Whatever the conduct of the plaintiff. Was irrelevant, but in time that changed. Okay, the principle of fairness and said, okay, is that a fair outcome to the case, became a key part of the discussion. Okay, so do bring in the principle of equity into that part of the answer. Okay, second way that you can get the law is the Irish Constitution. Okay, so Irish Constitution came into effect in 1937, and the only way that you can change the Irish Constitution is by referendum. And there's probably a fairly good chance that you're all well aware that on next Friday we're going to the polls, and that is to potentially seek the removal of the Eighth Amendment. So basically the principle, while you guys are doing the exam on Saturday morning, they will be counting the votes, and the overall outcome will be if the yes side wins by one vote, the Eighth Amendment will be removed. If the no side wins by one vote, the Eighth Amendment will remain in place, and that's the case of every referendum that we have. Okay, so one vote, so all the votes are added up together. Whichever side has more votes, that's the decision that's made. That's the only way you can change the Constitution, is by referendum. Okay, so the Irish Constitution, the second way we get our law. Third way we get our law is statutory legislation. Okay, so we have the men and women in the Dáil. And their job is to enact legislation. Okay, legislation is broken up into two types. There's superior legislation, okay, which is basically the more serious and the more important matters that we cover off. There's a 5-stage process in terms of changing the law. Minister presents a bill. Bill goes off to committee. Minister presents a bill. Initial stages of the bill are debated in the Dáil. Third stage is it goes off to committee. Fourth stage is that it's presented again. And then the fifth stage is that it's voted on within the Dáil. It's then brought, then passed, then sent to the Seanad for ratification, and then ultimately to the President, who will sign it into law. Okay, so that is the process for superior legislation. for subordinate legislation, which is the other way we do it. That's to handle less serious matters, things like kind of littering, kind of parking, and so on. All of that is delegated to the local authorities. Okay, so legislation is the third way that we get our laws. Briefly, yeah. Certainly, as I said in the example that I gave earlier, you know, listing the five of them is not going to get you a significant number of marks. Listing them and explaining and proving that you understand how they work, that will certainly go well towards getting you the marks that you're looking for.
You don't have to say how the common law started, because I started these at home. I ended up saying how common law, you know, all it, how it came in, started and all that, mm-hmm. and then I seen further down. You had to talk about common law, so I
there's a second question that so I would not go into the history of it. I mean, you could, you know, there's details of the history of the Constitution as well. I wouldn't go into 1922 and kind of so on, and then it got replaced with another constitution. I wouldn't go into the history of it. I would focus on how it works today.
Yeah. Okay. Do you need to mention the golden rule of Mr. Brogan?
Yeah. In which section? I wouldn't go into that level of detail. No. I mean, literally, you know, if you more or less wrote down word for word what I'm saying, that would be all I would be expecting in terms of the answer. I mean, I'll give you some general guidance towards the end of the session as to kind of what level of detail I'm kind of looking for, because that is important. Okay. But short answer, no, I wouldn't be expecting that level of detail. No. Okay. So fourth way that we get our law is the European law. Okay. So we joined the EEC in 1973. You have primary legislation, you have secondary legislation. Primary legislation are the treaties that we've signed over the years. And then the secondary legislation are the regulation, the directives and the decisions that we get from the European Union on a regular basis. Okay. So long story short, that's what I'm looking for. Okay. So common law and judicial precedent, that's one. You have the Constitution, that's two. The legislation, that's three. And you have the EU law, that's four.
Okay, because in the North as well, judicial precedent is listed as a separate, but it's actually with common law then.
They're kind of together. You can't really have one working without the other. It's the reason, I'm certainly aware of this. They are listed separately,
but
yeah.
They're
very, very closely related. Okay, the rest of them are fairly independent.
So they'll be as one.
They will be as one, yeah.
No,
that's fine. List them separately if you want. Yeah. I kind of crashed them together, because you wouldn't really have. I mean, because if you had common law without judicial precedent, you'd say, okay, well, you've a judge who's made a decision, and a judge has made another decision, and so on. But if you're not following judicial precedent, the question would be, well, so what? You know, the judge has made the decision, and so on. But if you're never going to refer to the decision, the answer would be, so what? Yeah. So you need judicial precedent before you can make the common law principle work. Okay, but there's no problem listing it as five, no. Okay. Yeah. So that's the first section. I wouldn't go into massive detail on them, but I would list them, yeah.
Would you list them for that question?
I'd list them, yeah. Okay.
Would you need to know them all, or could you just list a few?
I think... You know, like life, kind of a lot of it's in the marketing of it. You know, I would, if you can say, I'm here, I'm going to list them, and then you kind of leave out half of them, that's kind of, you know, it kind of makes you go, but if you kind of say, okay, as examples of the treaty are the, you know, this one and this one and this one, you say, okay, well, those are a couple of examples. So, yeah, it's, some of it is the way you write it, you know. As Declan says, it's an opportunity to show off, but some of it is in the way you write it.
Are dates important, like, you know, like on the cases and stuff?
On the actual cases.
Yeah, or even on those treaties.
Are the dates important? Not on the cases. No, if you know it, by all means, put it in. But not on the cases. On the treaties. Again, I would say, you know, if you know them, put them in. If you know half of them, I'd probably leave them out. And just going to say, okay, there was the Treaty of Paris, and there was the kind of Maastricht Treaty, and kind of list them kind of that way.
How many years the treaty is?
No, it's not. It's certainly not a lapse requirement. No.
Yeah.
And listen, if you don't know them, you know, if you get there, you know, maybe you go into the exam and you know them, and you draw a blank, you know, just don't put them in. You know, explain the stuff you do know. You know,
yeah.
Gonna say, okay, right, I'm gonna focus on primary legislation, which is the treaties, and then just don't mention them.
Yeah.
And then the secondary legislation, maybe you know secondary legislation a bit better, put a bit more detail into that. You know. Okay. So second half of the question is outline the principal differences between civil law and criminal law in Ireland. 10 marks for that. Okay. So civil proceedings are initiated by private individuals and companies, whereas criminal proceedings are commenced by the state. Okay, so it's one of the differences. Some of the categories of civil law. Civil law deals with things like contract and tort. Okay, so you get an assignment on each of that. Also deals with things like commercial law and also employment law. Okay, those type of cases are civil cases. Okay, regardless of the outcome of the case, nobody's going to prison. Okay, unless somebody lies on the stand. Okay, so nobody's going to prison based on a decision on contract, tort, commercial law, or employment law. However, in criminal law, that is potentially the case. So, what are the key differences? Okay, so in civil cases, parties are the defendant, are the plaintiff, and the defendant. Okay, in a criminal case, it is the state or it's the DPP versus, you know, if it's Paul Daly who's the defendant, it's versus Paul Daly. Okay. Civil law, the burden of proof shifts. Okay, so it's fairly 50-50 basically, based on, you know, the judge or the jury will hear the case and will make a decision. In criminal law, it has to be beyond. So for civil law, it's basically 50-50 in terms of the burden of proof. So a judge or a jury will sit and they will listen to the facts and they will say, okay, I either rule in favor of the plaintiff or I rule in favor of the defendant. In criminal law, the burden of proof is significantly weighted in favor of the defendant. Okay, it has to be beyond reasonable doubt that the person will be convicted. Okay, if it's not beyond reasonable doubt, jury or judge is supposed to acquit. In civil law, if you win a civil law case, what are you going to get? You're going to get damages. You could get an injunction which stops the other party doing whatever it is you don't like them doing. You can get the reverse, which is specific performance, which forces the other party. So if there's a contract to paint your house, the person refuses to do it, judge rules in your favor. The judge will say, okay, Mr. Painter, go and paint this person's house. Or you can get rescission of the contract, okay? So you might be looking for the contract to be basically torn up. Those are the four outcomes you can get in a civil case.
What was the last one,
sir? Rescission. So the contract is effectively basically torn up. Never happens. Now in criminal law, if you're on the wrong side of the case and you're found guilty, what are you looking at? You're looking at potential imprisonment, looking at a fine, looking at community service, or you're looking at binding over to the peace. Okay, so binding to the peace.
What does that mean?
Behave yourself.
Do it again.
You're not in. So the fourth one is, I mean, if you're found guilty in a criminal case, a decision that the judge may make is they may say, okay, you've done this. I don't deem it to be really, really, really serious. So as long as you behave yourself for 3 years, we'll forget about it. But if you come up in front of me again within the next 3 years and you're found guilty again, not only am I going to sentence you for whatever it is you did the second time round, I'm also going to impose a sentence for the first one.
Kind of suspended sentence,
yeah. So known as binding to peace. Imprisonment, fine, community service, and binding to peace. Okay. That's it. That's question one. Okay. So question two, two parts. And this time round, the marks are distributed slightly differently. It's 12 and 8. Okay. So if we translate that to a 30-minute session, you should be spending 18 minutes on the 12-parter and the remaining 12 minutes on the 8-part. Okay. So the 12-mark part of the question is, describe how common law has evolved, explain how it is applied to the courts today. So I'm just going to slightly flip it around for a moment and just quickly say, in terms of the second part of the question, we've answered it in first part, it's judicial precedent is how we apply common law today. Okay? Now, in terms of how it evolved, brief summary is, prior to the arrival of the Anglo-Normans in 1171, Ireland was governed by a principle, by a system based on custom, known as Breton law. And it was basically administrated by a gathering of travelling judges. So judges used to travel around the country, and whatever decision, whatever cases were brought to their attention, they would adjudicate and make rulings on. Okay? That's the way things worked up to the year 1171.
By a group of travelling?
Travelling judges. Then, from the arrival of the Anglo-Normans in 1171 until 1601, there was conflict in Ireland between the common law system, which was brought in by the Anglo-Normans, and Breton law. So you had both operating, okay, jostling for position. You still had your travelling judges, but you also had the principle of common law that had come in, which basically said, okay, there's going to be a court, the court is going to stay in one place, and then the concept of judicial precedent came into being. So you follow one case after another. Then in the year 1601, the Irish chieftains were defeated in the Battle of Kinsale, and Breton law more or less ended. So they need common law. Okay. And then the next major milestone was in the year 1800, when the Act of Union was signed, and that basically meant that all laws in Ireland came from Westminster in London. So prior to that, you kind of had Irish law and English law. In the year 1800, it basically said, right, it's English law, and that's all going to be applicable in Ireland as well. And again, you need to bring in the principles of equity, okay? So once upon a time, the law was the law. The behaviour of the plaintiff was pretty much ignored in the decision. People started appealing to the Court of the Chancery of the King. They said, okay, this is unfair, and it's unfair because of X, Y, Z. They would look at the case and say, okay, yeah, we agree with you. It is unfair because of X, Y, Z. So the concept of equity, which means fairness, came into the law. Okay? If you ever listen to a legal case, description of a legal case on the radio, you'll always hear some element of fairness being discussed. Okay? So it's not just the law is the law. Okay? And as I said, the second part of the question, judicial precedent, is how it's applied in the courts today.
Would that be enough for that thing, just that line?
Mm-hmm. Well, just that line.
Well, no, you're just going to just
the main thing, you know, and this won't be the last time I can mention it before we go out the door, is just keep showing you understand what it is that you're putting down on the paper. That's the best guidance that I give you in terms of your answers, okay? I mean, I can go off and learn a page of kind of nuclear physics, and maybe next Saturday somebody says, okay, Paul, tell me all about nuclear physics, and I can write down my page of nuclear physics. It doesn't mean I understand it, okay? So prove you understand what it is you're talking about.
So
the best advice
I can give you. The principle is how it's applied in the courts.
Mm-hmm. Certainly a concept, one of my abiding, I studied law many years ago, but one of the ones that keeps sticking in my head in terms of equity is that he who comes with equity must come with clean hands. Okay? So if your claim, yeah, absolutely, yep. Your predecessors last year certainly did, quite a number of them did.
Yeah.
So basically means if you're going to play the equity card, you need to be squeaky clean yourself, okay? Can't be saying it's unfair that I was sentenced for breaking into the guy's house.
Mm.
You can't say it was unfair that I got injured in the guy's house if the reason you got injured in the guy's house is because you were breaking into it. Mm. Okay.
There has been cases, though, hasn't
it? Oh, there is. Absolutely. Yeah. So that's if you're playing the equity cards, you know.
So what's the statement again?
He who comes with equity come with clean hands. So yeah, you're right, there has been cases like that. If you're playing the equity card, or if your lawyer is playing the equity card, they can't really play it they won't play it, basically. They won't play it if they don't think you're a squeaky clean. But there are also cases where things just happen to people, just through bad luck, and they actually are a squeaky clean. Okay, so that's the first part of question two. Second part of question two is explain the system of the courts in the Irish civil law court, Irish civil court system. There's 8 marks for that, so you should spend no more than 12 minutes on it. But basically what I'm looking for is, there is the district court, which is broken up into 23 regions, and covers all matters up to 15,000 euro. There's a circuit court, broken up into 8 jurisdictions. And they cover all matters between 15,000 and 75. and they can be used as an appeal court for the district court. If you don't like your decision there, you can appeal to the circuit court. It costs you a lot of money, but you can do it. And if you really have deep pockets, you can move on to the High Court. Okay. High Court has a president, and also a whopping 35 judges. Normally, three judges sit together. Okay. And then moving on from there, you have the Court of Criminal Appeal. The Court of Criminal Appeal is the High Court. It's just for, but it's called the Court of Criminal Appeal, and it's dealing with criminal matters that have been sent up for appeal from the Circuit Court, the Central Criminal Court, or the Special Criminal Court. And the last two you have is you have the Supreme Court, which is the final resort for all cases nationally. The Supreme Court has a Chief Justice and seven judges. You'll always have at least three sitting together. And then finally, you have the European Court of Justice. The key thing for the European Court of Justice is you can only appeal to it if you feel a European right has been violated. You can't just go straight to the ECJ and say, I don't like the verdict from the Supreme Court. It has to be based on the fact my ability to move around has been impeded, my ability to move my goods has been impeded. There has to be some European law that you're appealing on. Okay, so there's there's five. District Circuit is two. High Court is three, Supreme Court is four, and ECJ is five, and you can briefly mention the Court of Criminal Appeal as the sixth one as well. But that is our court system. Okay, that's question two. Now, question three comes in two parts, and this is the issue of contracts. So the first two questions come from the beginning of section one. Okay, so that's the first section you would have covered off. Question three is in relation to contract, which is the second part of the first module. Now, the way that's broken up is you have 12 marks for the first question and 8 marks for the second. Question one, first part of the question is explain the essential elements of contract. Okay, so to be honest, I'm kind of more or less, unless people really want me to cover it, I'm going to more or less skip that in the interest of time, because you all did an assignment on it. That's offer, acceptance, consideration, and intention to create legal relations. You all did an assignment on it, and you all nailed it. So you all knew.
Would you have a paragraph roughly though on each of them to explain?
Absolutely, yes. Do not do what the fellow did last year, which is offer, acceptance, consideration, legal relations, full marks, please. Okay.
Do you have to mention case law in the
It would be a good idea to mention a couple of cases, yes. I mean, one that you should all know very well is the Carlisle case, so I'd expect to at least see that. In relation to cases, don't waste time telling me the facts of a case. Okay, you can take it as a given that I know what the facts of the case are. Okay,
you mentioned the case, and that's
you mention the case and mention why you're mentioning the case. You know, this was proven in this case.
Yeah.
You know, you can take it as a given that I know the facts, because I know you're short on time. If you have to explain the facts of the Carlisle case, you're going to lose.
Yeah.
You're going to lose 3 or 4 minutes kind of writing that down. So. You can take it as a given that I know the facts of that case or any other case that you mentioned, okay?
Yeah.
Mention why you're mentioning it. But contract law and tort are very much based on case law, okay? So if we think back to question one, we're talking about kind of common law. So a case, one case happens, second case happens, third case happens, and that's how the law is made. So the cases are important. So it'd be good to mention a couple of them. If you want to really kind of impress me, mention kind of maybe more than a couple of them, you know? People who did that last year tended to be the people who got the top marks. Okay. So are people comfortable on the offer, acceptance, consideration, that stuff, or do you need me to go through it? In the interest of time, I'm probably going to skip it, because the assignment suggests that you are comfortable with it.
Just ask a question about the implied terms. I was a bit stuck on that.
Yep. So that's actually the second part, so I'm going to go through that part right now.
Okay.
Yeah, because that wasn't covered in massive detail. It was part of it, but it wasn't covered in massive detail in the assignment, so I will cover that part. So, where are we now?
Terms of contract.
Voila. Okay. So, terms of contract. contract terms are come in two types, okay? There's express terms and there's implied terms, okay? Express terms are going to be actually written down in the contract, okay? Good example would be, you're never going to have a contract with somebody that says, build me a house, okay? So I can go off and I can build you a one-bedroom house. I say, there you go, there's your house. I say, oh, hang on, I want it five bedrooms. Never said five bedrooms. So I'll build you a house, there's your house, okay? So, you know, so express terms are the important parts of the contract, okay? You're going to actually write it down. You're not going to say, contract is to buy a piece of land. You're going to say what piece of land that you're buying. What car are you buying? You're going to put the important things in the contract. Those are the express terms. Okay? The implied terms are the ones that you're not going to put in the contract, but we kind of assume that we are aligned on the implied terms. Okay? So the best example, you know, there is stuff in the kind of Sale of the Goods Act and so on in relation to cars, but the best example is if you buy a car off someone, the expectation is that the car goes. All right? If for whatever reason you're buying an ancient car or you're buying it for parts or whatever, so the car does not go, you would probably make that an express term. You would actually write it in the contract before you sign it, say we are in a full agreement that this car does not go. Right? Implied term is the car goes. Okay? So express terms come into a couple of different categories. You have one known as conditions, okay, which is basically what I just said. It's a vital term of the contract. A condition is a vital term of the contract. Okay? If a condition is broken or not met, the party that's out of pocket is entitled to rescind the contract. So you have condition. You have a warranty, which is a more minor term, but it's still important. Okay? So if the warranty is broken, you can't rescind the contract. You can't walk away altogether, but if you're the injured party, you're entitled to damages, okay? So, I don't know, Windows would be the kind of... Okay, so, I don't know, say you want it, let's stick with the house example. Say there's a contract to build a house, and you wanted, say, double glazing windows put in, okay? The builder doesn't put in double glazing windows, they put in... I'm not an expert, but I presume it's not a single glazing windows. But okay, they just put in normal bog standard windows. Okay, now you can kind of rip those windows out and you can replace them, but you know it's going to be a nuisance one way or the other. Okay, and the ultimate outcome is with the single glazing, more heat is going to escape from the house versus the double glazing. So the person who's buying the house can't necessarily walk away and say, well, you didn't give me my windows, so I'm walking away from the entire contract. The court probably won't allow that. But what they will allow is maybe a knockdown on the price, some damages given to the injured party to either one, get the windows in that they want, or two, maybe they keep the single glazing, but it's going to cost them an extra $1,000 a year on heating bills. Maybe they reflect that in the final agreed price of the house. Okay, that's a warranty. You have a condition, which is a key term. If there's no house, you're entitled to rescind the contract. Warranty, if there's a house but the windows are wrong, you get some damages. You can't necessarily walk away. And finally, there's what's known as mere representations, okay? By the way, the house is going to have a red door. Okay, can you walk away from the contract if the door is blue instead of red? No. Are you going to get damages because the door is blue instead of red? Probably not either. It's a mere representation. If the builder says, oh, by the way, we're going to build your house, it's going to have a red door. They're mentioning it's going to have a red door, but you can't necessarily fully rely on it. It's only it's a by-the-by comment, okay? Those are your express terms. Implied terms, the main point we're looking for, so that's a set of implied terms are things where you think you're aligned. Frequently things end up in court because people are not aligned. What is going to happen is what is known as the officious bystander test is going to be applied. Very similar one in tort, known as the reasonable man test. So it's basically going to be, okay, if we stop 10 people on the street and we say, what is your interpretation of X, Y, Z? Whatever the answers are, that's what the court's going to rely on. Okay, there's a good example. I don't have the case there in front of me, but there is a good example. There's some discussion of cattle. Okay? All right? If you stop 10 people in the street and you say, okay, are pigs part of cattle? 9 or 10 of them are probably going to say no. Okay? But there was what the person was trying to argue was, okay, there was agreement on cattle. I thought that pigs were included as cattle. So what the court would, they don't necessarily do the actual investigation themselves, but the example would be if they went out in the street, asked 10 people, what are cattle? If they say they include pigs, then you say, okay, well, maybe the guy's right. If all of them say, well, no, for me, pigs are not cattle, then they're going to rule on the other side. Question?
Yeah, so it's like in the case we saw with banana, were not referenced as the other fruits for imports we saw in the previous case.
Yep. Okay. So that's question three. Okay. All right. Good so far. Okay. Question four. So question four, it's just a one-parter, okay, so there's no second part. Question is, in relation to company law, explain how a private company differs from that of a sole trader. Okay? So you can get your answer from here, but you would also have covered a lot of this in credit management as well if you've already done that. But basically, there's four things we're looking for. One, it's legally separate from the owners. Two, there's limited liability. This is with a limited company. So sole traders, company and the person are one. Limited company, they're separate. So I'll go into more detail on these in a minute, but just to list them off. Second difference is limited liability with a limited company. Third thing is there is transferable shares. And the last thing is continuous existence. So just to put a bit more detail on that. So legally separate from the owners. Okay, so when you're a sole trader, you basically are the company. Okay, Declan is effectively a sole trader. Okay, so you are the company. All right. When it's a limited company, you're separate from the owners. Okay, so I mean, if you're a sole trader and you own a car, you know, that's your car. It's also kind of the business's car. Okay, so you know, if you go bankrupt, theoretically, the creditors can go and take possession of that car, sell the car, use the money to clear the debts. If it's a limited company, and Declan's the director of the limited company, that can't happen, okay? Declan has his car, that's his car, it does not belong to the company, okay? Now, if there is a company car that actually belongs to the company, yes, then that can be sold. But Declan's car is not up for discussion. If Declan is a sole trader rather than a director of the company, it is up for grabs. Okay, so that's the first point. They're legally separate. Second one is limited liability. Okay, so you know the government and the state want to encourage companies to set up. Okay, why do they want to encourage companies to set up? Companies mean jobs. It also means tax revenue, both from the company and from the employees that will get the jobs with the company. So they want to encourage it. So one of the ways they do it is, you know, some companies are successful, some fail. The way that they do it is they encourage people to set up companies. The way they do it is they have limited liability. Okay, so if a company makes an attempt to make money and fails, basically it's the assets of the company that are available up for grabs. It's not too dissimilar to the first point, but you know, there is a bit of a difference. There's limited liability, okay? The directors can walk away and set up another company. They can fail again. They can try a third time. You know, the government wants to encourage this, okay? So there is limited liability. So it extends. So similar to the first example, if Declan has a big house on the hill, it's not up for grabs for the company, okay? If there's a building that the company owns, yes, that's up for grabs. But the big house on the hill, no matter how rich Declan is, you can't touch the assets that Declan has. You can only touch the assets that the company has. Okay, so there's limited liability. Okay, you're only going to be hit for so much if the company fails. It's not going to ruin the directors, because if you ruin the directors, they're not going to take another punt and try again. Okay. There are transferable shares in a company. Okay, so people own a company. Companies don't just exist; people own them. Okay, they're either owned by a couple of people, or they're potentially owned by thousands who, you know, maybe it's a public company and shares have been sold and they're owned by thousands of people, okay? So everyone owns a little bit of the company. It's worth 10,000, 100,000, 10 million, it's worth something anyway, hopefully. They can then sell that on, okay? They can sell the company to somebody else and say, okay, here's my shares, now you own that part of the company, I walk away, okay? When you're a sole trader, you can't do that. You are the company. Okay, you can't sell bits of your business because you are the business. And then finally, you have continuous existence, okay? This company is in existence, have been going on for hundreds of years, okay? The founder is long dead, all right? The company continues on, all right? So sole traders, normally when a sole trader dies or retires, that's it. They are the business, doesn't go on, okay? But when it's a company, you know, you can sell, you know, when you reach retirement age, you can sell your stake in the company, you walk away with your money, somebody else, who's presumably younger, takes it on and keeps going. And with companies, that happens potentially for hundreds of years. So that's what I'm looking for. So just to recap, legally separate from the owners, limited liability, transferable shares, continuous existence. Four traits of a limited company that a sole trader does not have.
Is there any point in mentioning the Memorandum and Articles of Association and the corporate veil?
Corporate veil, yes. Yeah, you could put a line or two in on the corporate veil. Memorandum and Articles of Association, not really, no. No.
And the veil of incorporation, should you mention that in there, should you?
Sorry, say that again?
The veil of incorporation, should you mention that in there?
You can, yeah? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's linked to the two. It, you know, establishes that you're aware that the person running the company is not the company themselves. Okay. So question five also comes from the company law section. So this is module two. So I'm just going to go through this pretty quickly. It's explain the role of each of the following as defined in company law. There's nothing necessarily overly tricky about these. The three things that we're looking for is the company director. Explain what the company director is, there's 5 marks for that. Explain what the auditor is, there's 5 marks for that. Explain what the liquidator is, there's 10 marks for that, because it's a little bit more complicated. So it's 5, 5, and 10, so basically it translates to 7.5 minutes writing on the company director, 7.5 minutes writing on the auditor, and 15 minutes writing on the liquidator. Nothing too tricky in it, but I'll just quickly go through it. Company director, what are they responsible for? The 1990 Act placed new responsibilities on directors of limited companies for the first time in history. Company directors were held personally liable for non-compliance with statutory legislation. Okay, it was chaos prior to 1990. All limited companies are required to file an annual return within a specified time frame to the CRO, the company's registration office. Penalties for non-compliance, okay, and the directors are personally responsible for that. Penalties can be imposed on the directors themselves as well as the company. In exchange for the privilege of separate legal personality and limited liability, registered companies are required to disclose certain facts about themselves to the general public. So again, they have to file returns, share information. What information they have to share varies depending on the size of the company.
Does that really mention the enactment of directors, is that what you were getting at there?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you mentioned there.
The last couple of things they need to do, directors need to maintain the records, they need to keep the stuff for 6 years. Again, it's their head on the block if you go looking for stuff that's 3 years old and they don't have it. And the last thing they need to do is they need to be able to appoint, they need to appoint auditors, okay? Can't just say, yeah, it's all grand, I checked it myself. You need somebody to come in external to have a look at the books and confirm that it is all grand. So that's what company directors do. Okay. All in the notes, nothing too tricky there. Auditors. Like I said, every company must appoint an auditor or auditors, with the exception of SMEs. Register of auditors is maintained by the CRO. Okay. All right, and then giving any false or misleading information or failing to provide information to the auditors is an offence. Okay, so the auditors go in, they check the books, they confirm that everything the directors have said is actually correct. And finally, the liquidator. Okay. So liquidator conducts a liquidation or a winding up of the company. There's three different types of winding ups you can have. Regardless of whether it's voluntary or compulsory, the role of the liquidator is basically the same. Once appointed, liquidator must notify the CRO that they're there. C- CRO will tell the ODCE, Director of Corporate Enforcement. Duties of a liquidator are to take possession of a company's assets and protect them. So stop the directors grabbing them and running off to Brazil. Make a list of the debtors, list of the creditors. Try to see what they can do for the creditors. Resolve disputed cases of ownership. And then sell the assets of the company, getting as much as they can. And then distribute the money as best they can among the creditors. There is a pecking order, though. The people at the top of the pecking order are the liquidators themselves. They have to be paid. They ain't going to do it for free. So I'm going to pause this.